Thursday edition of Locked On NBA. Locke and Golliver back with you. The games get back underway tonight. Cleveland's got a new coach. There's all sorts of little stuff, but we're going to go with the 4, 5, 6 storylines that we're most interested to see in this final 29-game sprint of the NBA. I'm David Locke. He's Ben Golliver, Washington Post NBA writer. And Ben, the Bucks to 70 are your storyline you're most interested in. What are you expecting this team to do down the stretch? They've proven that they're the dominant regular season team in the NBA.
Well, look, I think it's a good sign, Locke, that we're coming out of a nice all-star break where it sounds like you had some good time with your family. I got a lot of fun in Chicago, and we were having difficulty narrowing it down to just 5 stories. I think that's a great sign for, you know, the next month or two to come. There's a lot going on. To me, I always start at the top when it comes to the biggest storylines, and that's why I have to go with Milwaukee. Look, if we hadn't had Golden State a couple of years ago run off the 73, the Bucks would be getting way, way, way more buzz for their chase of 70, I think. You know, part of it is that season for Steph Curry and the Warriors was just so magical. It's kind of a big market team. They're this flashy, glitzy team that was just kind of on the rise. They were media darlings, and Milwaukee isn't quite that. Of course, they've got the reigning MVP, a guy who's probably going to be the back-to-back MVP with Giannis, but they're not out here sort of courting attention or necessarily going out of their way to draw, you know, media coverage. And yet they deserve all of it. I mean, this is a team that could absolutely win 70 games if they try. The main question is, are they going to be sprinting through the finish line, or are they going to be resting guys down the stretch once they've, you know, cinched up that number one seed in the Eastern Conference? I'll be honest, I hope they go for it a little bit, because they've been one of the most dominant teams in NBA history all season long, smacking teams left and right, and I love a good chase. So I'm not saying I would bet that they win 70, but I'm going to be keeping an eye on it for the next 6 weeks, no question about it.
What do you need to see from them in this final stretch that makes you comfortable about saying that this all the stats are real and this is their title?
Well, I'm not going to say it's their title, because I think there's a lot of teams that are capable of winning the championship, but they're my favorites right now. I believe in the stats. I mean, it's really hard to beat teams as badly as they do it, especially when you're not playing your main guys that many minutes. I think that they have another gear to go to during the playoffs. I know a lot of people are concerned, is this a regular season team? Is it a playoff team? I think that the biggest, you know, upgrade that any team can make here at the deadline is just, you know, the Bucks deciding that they want to play Giannis, you know, normal superstar minutes in the playoffs. Like, once he's going from, you know, around 30 up to, say, 38 in the playoffs, that's going to be a lot of quality minutes that you're going to be benefiting from that they're just not really dealing with right now. So I'm convinced. I'm sold. I know a lot of other people aren't. Of course, there's going to be concerns with any team. They're not perfect. They're not a super team in the traditional sense. It's not like they're rolling out lineups with 5 all-stars in the starting lineup. But they're very, very, very good. And to me, they're clearly the class of the Eastern Conference.
The argument that they're a regular season team is that their defensive system allows you to shoot threes. And when they play a good three-point shooting team like they did Christmas Day with Philadelphia, they lose. That Giannis is still a little limited offensively when it gets you into half-court grinder. And that Eric Bledsoe is an inadequate playoff player, and without Malcolm Brogdon, they're relying on him even more than ever. How legitimate are those three?
Well, I think they're legitimate to various degrees. Okay, Philly's not going to shoot like they did on Christmas every single night, but the fact that they do want to play, you know, kind of drop and give up three-pointers at various points can come back to bite them if a team gets hot, and especially if a team is sort of balanced and has kind of offensive weapons in various spots. You look at Toronto and Boston, they check a lot of those boxes. And so those teams are going to, you know, put up a fight. Or I just think that, like, I would rather have Giannis and whatever other flaws that group has than have any other team in the Eastern Conference's, you know, balance of strength and weaknesses. I just think he's, like, that far of a cut above everyone else. Now, we did see some flaw from him at the All-Star game, like you're describing. Late in the game, he is not really creating shots for himself off the dribble. He's not stepping forward in that true superstar manner and saying, give me the ball, get out of the way. And that was a little bit concerning. Now, at the same time, his team was significantly worse than Team LeBron. And, you know, Team LeBron was able to kind of like load up almost. And I do think that took Giannis and his teammates out of their offensive desires in the All-Star game. But it was a reminder that they can hit a wall at times with their offensive flow, like they did in the playoffs last year against Toronto. So to me, that's one to watch. But, you know, ultimately, like, the Bledsoe factor, that's a real deal. But I think that they've kind of hedged their lineups away from him just enough. You know, like, to me, they're getting good minutes from, like, DiVincenzo, Wesley Matthews, and George Hill has been huge for them. I think that if Bledsoe winds up doing what he does sort of every year, which is kind of fall to pieces under the pressure moments, they're going to have other people to turn to, even without Malcolm Brogdon.
The Houston Rockets went small, trading Clint Capella. To me, this is one of the most interesting stories. If you actually, if Bojan Bogdanović does not hit one of the most remarkable shots, they would
shot of the year.
They would have, since the trade deadline, they would have, I think, they lost to Phoenix on a night where Russ didn't play. They didn't play their guys. They would have beat Utah, Boston, the Lakers, and the Pelicans, and Dallas, I think. They were before trade deadline. Houston, if you look at the numbers of what they did here, it makes all the sense in the world. When Harden and Westbrook were both on the floor, they were plus 5.2. But with Capella off, they were plus 12.3. With Westbrook but no Harden, they're not as good. But Harden without Westbrook, plus 7. And Harden without Westbrook and Capella, plus 13 with an offensive rating of 119. This team is unstoppable offensively. They have shown an ability to beat the best teams in the league, Boston, the Lakers, and they really, for all intents and purposes, had Utah. I think this is going to be a fascinating stretch, and I think they're going to be wildly successful.
Well, I'll say this. I mean, they're really, really fun to watch. They've been fun to watch since that trade. I do think that some of it is just like the mojo wasn't right, so you're lightening the mood by kind of shaking things up. But then I think most of it is what you're describing, which is you're now unlocking Westbrook in a way that he wasn't able to be unlocked when you had another non-shooter on the court with him in Clint Capella. Of course, you know, Harden's going to benefit from that extra spacing as well, and they've looked really, really good on offense. I guess for me, though, like you're describing some of the skepticism that people have towards the Bucks. That's how I feel towards the Houston Rockets, right? Because we've seen multiple years where they sort of hit a wall or they hit a ceiling when they get against a really, really good team like the Golden State Warriors in these playoffs. And I don't think there's a team as good as last year's Warriors, you know, in the Western Conference bracket this year. But I can see a team like the Clippers, the Lakers, and some of the other Western Conference teams being able to sort of win a war of attrition against them, being able to outlast them in a postseason series, and then ultimately being able to kind of figure out what's the best way to defend them, you know, as the series unfolds. We've seen Harden encounter some issues just from a burden standpoint as series go along. And then ultimately, I'll just be frank, I don't trust Westbrook, even an unlocked Westbrook, deep into the playoffs, because we just really haven't seen it from him as being sort of that go-to type of guy. I think he's actually in a better situation now for his own personal success than really at any point since Kevin Durant left Oklahoma City and they were teammates. So for him, that's a big win. But I also worry about their health, you know, because if one of those guys, whether it's Tucker or Covington, misses any time, you know, they're perilously thin. But that was another benefit of that Capella trade. You know, he's already dealing kind of banged up, dealing with some injury issues here after that trade for Atlanta. And I think being able to just kind of go to war with the guys they have was the preferable approach for them.
Westbrook took 50% of his shots this year at the rim when Capella's off the floor, 40% when Capella was on the floor. It is an unleashed Westbrook. Here's another note on this. Go to 538. They give a rating on every game, what your winning percentage of your game is. The Rockets, 16 of their final 16 of their final 28 games are 80% winning percentage or better. 16 of their final 28 games are basically gimmies.
So that's, I mean, and look, this number two seed is open in the Western Conference, right? Like that one hasn't been sealed up. So if they're able to go on a real run here and string a bunch of wins together, that shakes up the entire conference picture to me, right? And I think it also really puts pressure on a team like the Clippers, where, you know, they've been kind of jogging or kind of going three-quarter speed all season long in terms of how they milk guys when they're injured and giving them the extra rest and everything else. I mean, I think if you're the Clippers, like, you know, your motivation to try to get that two seed should be huge, because you know, any of the teams in that mix, whether it's Denver or Houston, going to be tough outs, or Utah as well. And, you know, it's not like the Clippers are, you know, despite their recent moves, I mean, I think they're the deepest team in the conference, but they're not some overwhelming favorite here where they're going to want to open up a tough second round series on the road. So I think from that standpoint, you know, Houston could be applying some real pressure to these other aspiring contenders here down the stretch. And that's for sure a story to watch.
Let's dig more into the Clippers on our next storyline. I think that's a bigger deal, but you're absolutely right. By the way, here's those four Western Conference teams you mentioned. According to 538, games left that have an 80% winning percentage or better. Rockets 16, Clippers 11, Nuggets 7, Jazz 6. The rest of the way, each of those teams with 28 to play. If you take winning percentage of 60% or better, but that's not the same as just a gimme, Rockets 19, Clippers 22, Rockets 19, Nuggets 17, Jazz 17. So we'll talk about that and how the Clippers approach that. I just got back from helicopter skiing. That was my enjoyment. And thank goodness I brought my Theragun with me. The Theragun is the original professional-grade handheld therapy device, deep muscle tissue treatment, relieve tension, improve mobility, accelerate recovery, and enhance performance. After day two, 12 helicopter runs over at Ruby Helicopter. Incredible day. Absolutely went to the Theragun afterwards to empower myself to be able to get through the next day. The Theragun exists to empower everybody on earth to feel their best naturally. The products, services create wellness naturally, helping recovery, helping reconnect your body, eliminating all the negative mojo you get in your body. The Theragun will make you recover faster. It will give you better performance, and it will release the tension that you have in your muscles. So make sure you check it out. Feel better naturally, treat your pain, and get back to life. Theragun will give you a risk-free 30-day or your money back at theragun.com/lockedon. For a limited time, my listeners to this podcast get a free charging stand with the purchase. That's a $79 value. That's theragun.com/lockedon, theragun.com/lockedon. And more importantly, thank you, Theragun, for helping me get through my helicopter skiing trip. I broke down the schedules there for you, Ben. The Clippers are the mystery here, right? Because they have 22 games where they have 60% winning percentage or better. They only have six games in which their winning percentage is below 60% the rest of the way. If they go at it, they should be fine. If they dig in, play the final 20 games at full throttle, they should be fine. They should be certain to be the two or three seed in the West. But if they don't, and they slide to four, that becomes crazy. They have to get the Lakers in the second round, and they get either probably the Jazz or the Rockets in the first round.
Yeah, I think if you're the Clippers, your primary goal is to, you know, defer how long you have to play off LeBron in the playoffs, because I do think there's going to be a concern with him where, you know, he's going to be going all out, as always, in the playoffs. He misses out last year. He's going to be going in there, you know, he's doing his typical zero dark 23 thing where he's all locked in and going guns blazing. You want to delay that matchup as long as you can, because I think ultimately you're trying to outlast him, right? So if you're the Clippers, like you're saying, in the four seed would be just an absolute disaster for them. And I'll be honest, you know, being here in LA, I've given them a very wide berth. You know, I've listened to say, okay, well, we're going to bring Paul George back slowly. Oh, you know, he gets something else, you know, a little nick here and there. We're going to give him a bunch of nights off. Kawhi Leonard, he's going to get load managed at times and everything else. And when you look at their deadline moves, they're right in line with what you would expect. Loading up with veterans, whether it's Marcus Morris, Reggie Jackson, you know, trying to keep some of that talent away from the Lakers, cashing in a future first-round pick. I mean, it all kind of adds up to what their, you know, philosophical goal coming into this season was, which is make it to the playoffs, you know, be healthy and be ready to go, right? So they're on track with what they've said, but they've also reached the stage of the season, to me, Locke, where they've got to prove it, right? Like, let's go out there and play to your peak ability more consistently. You know, in the Western Conference, I think they're only third in point differential right now. They're sixth overall in the league, you know, coming out of the All-Star break. They should be better than that. You know, that should be a team that's like a top 3 point differential team. And so, you know, let's see them kick it up a notch. That's what I'm looking forward down the stretch from them.
Paul George hamstring strain on the final game of the All-Star break. So it didn't right before the break. How concerning is this that perked up again?
Well, for him, it's just one thing after another. And I think that's the scary part, because if you look back at his track record in the playoffs, he's been inconsistent, right? And last year, of course, it was the shoulders. And, he kind of, not that he no-showed against Portland, but he certainly was not himself. And I think it was a key factor in the Blazers winning that series. I think he enters the playoffs with more pressure and more scrutiny than any other player, right? Because the Clippers should be viewed as one of the title favorites. He's an absolute X factor for them. If he's not healthy or something else gets in the way, he's not consistently performing to his ability, they're going to have a much harder time winning the title this year. I just view him as completely central to what their plans are. And so, you look around, you could say similar things about Anthony Davis, but I think he's been a much more consistent contributor this season for the Lakers. He's been healthier as well. And I just think, with Paul George, and he's called himself Playoff P in the past, he's gone out in the first round a whole bunch of years in a row. And the Clippers, frankly, are in title or bust mode. You add all those things up, I think it's just a lot of pressure and a lot of scrutiny on him that, a number of the other guys who are sort of in his class, as top 10 level guys, I don't think they're going to be taking as much heat potentially in the media than he will.
Well, he did completely no-show against the Jazz in game 6 of a deciding game of a playoff series. So he may not have no-showed last year because you're going to give him a pass with the shoulder, but his game 6 with the Thunder against the Jazz is one of the big-time players' worst playoff games you can imagine. So he's on the hook for that one. All right, let me give you a number here. You're in L.A. You're watching them all the time. You just talked about Zero Dark 23 or whatever LeBron goes into. I have a statistic that I use to evaluate offensive players, and it's been very good to me, particularly to kind of see aging. And the concept behind this is, I call it points gained. If a player uses 20 possessions on a night, how many points does he score more than what an average player in the league would do? So when LeBron was at his peak in the 13-14 season, he was a 4.5, one of the better seasons you'll ever see. You usually have three guys a year over three. 14-15, his first year back in Cleveland, he's a 1.7. Then he's a 2.0. 16-17 in Cleveland is probably best year back there. He goes to 2.8, and he's 2.8 again in 17-18. Last year, 18-19, he's a 1.3, and this year he's a 0.3.
Wow.
Okay, so he goes from 2.8 back-to-back years to 1.3 points better than average players with his 23 scoring opportunities a night, and this year he's a 0.3 in his 22 scoring opportunities a night. That is aging. He's not the same. He's unbelievable. 25 points, 8 rebounds, 11 assists, but it's not quite the same. Can you tell watching him, do you think we will know anything in the next 29 games of whether or not he can get back to being the same?
Well, that's fascinating because, real plus minus, he's like the ultimate darling of that stat this year, like on both ends, right? And in that one, it's like it feels like it's too optimistic. Yours is way more pessimistic than I would have expected. There are some red flags. I mean, I think the main one is late in games when he's playing against superstars sort of like of the next generation guys behind him, right? So I'm talking about like that Blazers game with Damian Lillard or the head-to-head showdown with Giannis or the games against Kawhi Leonard, both times this year. He's been outlasted, right? Their late game offense has broken down in part because he's not able to get to the basket and generate the high quality looks that you would want, in part because he's settling for three pointers at times or even deferring to Anthony Davis for like isolation opportunities at times late in those games. To me, that's sort of been the biggest, bugaboo in LeBron's game. Now you look at his overall efficiency. I mean, it's definitely slipped offensively, and the free throw numbers, what he's complained about in terms of not getting to the line as often as he has in past years, I think that's another kind of telltale sign of aging. And then he hasn't shot the ball very well from the free throw line either. So I expect him to go, if he goes down in the playoffs, he will go down with a fight. I think that in general, he saves stuff, especially even during those Cleveland years. I mean, he always was able to kick it up at least a notch, if not two. And he doesn't really face, to me, a defense that's going to be as imposing as the Warriors defense was these past couple of years, because they just had so much personnel collected to deal with him, from Klay to Iguodala to Draymond to Kevin Durant. And there's no team in these playoffs, not even the Clippers, who has that sort of depth of talent and experience to throw on him. So I think he'll look a little bit better, relative to those series against the Warriors, just because of the quality of the competition. But I do worry about his aging for sure, especially when he's, getting into those late game situations where the miles are adding up, where he's playing against younger stars who still have their legs, and where he's being asked to kind of do everything and orchestrate for the Lakers. It's a huge burden, and, it only increases the deeper you go in the playoffs. A
few notes to back you up on that. Lakers this year in the clutch, so games within 5 points in the final 5 minutes, rank 20th in the league offensively. And these are stunning. LeBron James, 17 of 53 for 32% shooting on 4 of 25 from 3. So two things about that. 4 of 25 is stunning. But in the clutch, 50% of his shot attempts are threes. And he's 4 of 25. 52 of 53. 25 of 53 shots. At the free throw line, he's 14 of 23, 61%. He's committed 10 turnovers and has 22 assists. 22 assists is kind of awesome. 10 turnovers is probably a little high for him. Plus minus is fine, as it always is. Interesting to see 32%, 16% from three, and nearly 50% of his shots are threes.
Yeah, I think some of the three-point number going down is just, not having your legs late in the game. I think some of it is just you're taking contested shots or you're forcing them late in the shot clock. It's kind of bailout shots. So I think there are different factors that could describe it. But, yeah, I mean, those numbers add up with exactly the eye test, right, or exactly what you're seeing if you're watching these games. It's not to say that he's, a choker or anything along those lines. It's just, he's reached a reality where he's not where he was when he was 28 or 29 years old from a physical perspective, where when he needed a basket, he could just put his shoulder down, turn the corner and get himself to the free throw line or get himself a layup. That just hasn't been the story this year, especially when he's playing against sort of elite competition.
One more note on that, and then we'll look at some other of our storylines. We continue. Ben Golliver, Thursday edition of Rejecting the Screen is out this week as well. Really interesting long-form interviews going ISO on Thursdays. These guys come up with, Adam and Noah come up with some great interviews. They actually had Anthony Morrow on last week, who talked a lot about where he thinks KD is right now and what's going on with him and why he kind of continually is acting out. And this week also a very good interview. Coming up, going back to the drafting of Giannis in Milwaukee. Some good stories about that. So that's Rejecting the Screen. One more note on that. Final 3 minutes of Lakers game this year within one possession. LeBron James, 5 of 20, 0 of 7 from 3. Anthony Davis, 10 of 18, 56%, 5 of 8 from 3, 13 of 16 from the free throw line.
That's actually better than I expected, because he's had some moments where he makes questionable decisions, and they don't always get him set up in the best proper place. He's not a guy who's like isolating a lot. I mean, so much of their offense throughout the course of a game winds up coming from the pick and roll, and they're so devastating there. But when the game slows down late, he gets into some of these isolation situations, and I feel like it doesn't always go productive places. But he's an incredible offensive talent, and it's like, okay, look, if the ball's not going to be in LeBron's hands, you know exactly whose hands you want it in. A lot of times he will draw a double if they do pound it to him. That helps set up some of their shooters. You swing the ball around, you find Danny Green in the corner. That type of thing is really good offense, especially in the playoffs. So they've got more than one weapon. I don't think that we need to be writing off the Lakers as a team that's, like a false contender or anything like that. But I do think that the majority of their late game decisions are going to be made by LeBron, and he's going to have to play better in the playoffs than he has so far in those situations during the regular season.
To sum this up, I think my storyline is kind of this interesting game of, like, is it Anthony Davis's team? Is it LeBron's team? I'm watching that for the final 29 games of the season. It's probably where I am there. What we're all watching for the final 29 games, might have any playoff, is Zion. Like, Zion is the focus of all of our attention.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, he was the focus of my attention throughout All-Star Weekend. I mean, watching his joy meeting Barack Obama, and just the notion that Barack Obama, it seemed like he went out of his way to meet Zion, which is like, what more validation can you get as a teenager than a presidential seal of approval, right? But I think that, you know, coming into the All-Star break, I was probably at like 98% that Ja Morant was going to be my Rookie of the Year pick. You know, it would take something really crazy to kind of spin in a different direction. But the more that I've been thinking about it, like, you know, the Grizzlies open up this second half of the season or the stretch run with a pretty tough road trip, games against the Rockets, the Lakers, and the Clippers. So that six-game lead that they have basically over a team like the Pelicans could be cut in half by the end of next week. And now things start to get really, really interesting. If you have a situation where Zion is potentially leading the Pelicans back into that playoff picture and they're bumping out the Grizzlies, I think that just like the content machine is going to be like, you know, working in overdrive to kind of give Zion all the credit for that. His plus minus numbers, his impact numbers are incredible. You know, box score stats at 22-7-2, you know, and of course he's got all the highlights. And I think he's, you know, one of the NBA's, if not the most popular young player, than one of them. I mean, that's an awful lot of things to, you know, that will make this Rookie of the Year race interesting. Now, to me, I still default to who has the bigger body of the work, who has, you know, more total impact over the course of the season. So I'm probably still at like 90% or maybe 85% for Ja Morant to win that Rookie of the Year race. But I do think that, like, to me, Zion's become appointment television, you know, basically no other way around it. And if that continues and it shows progress in the standings for them, and they've got a pretty easy schedule to close this thing out, you know, they're going to get a lot of debates, you know, Ja versus Zion, Zion versus Ja, that type of thing.
The fact you're not at 100% on this is really disappointing to me. But Zion Williamson is incredible. It's absurd that you're talking about him as being Rookie of the Year, playing 35 games. So I'll forgive you for this lunacy, considering you followed him.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm sure.
Locke, are you sure, though?
I'm sure. 100% sure.
All right, we'll check back in a month. How's that?
Well, Ja Morant's been amazing. If we had the Malcolm Brogdon year or the Michael Carter Williams year, I'd have a different opinion. But we have a guy who's deserving and is unbelievable.
No, I'm with you. I love Ja Morant. I'm not trying to take anything away from him. I'm just saying that, like, you know, Zion is a different kind of player. It's a phenomenon type of thing going on with him.
And the other phenomena is that New Orleans can't win games consistently.
Oh, you're betting – you're counting them out. Okay, we'll see. I think they're going to make this thing really interesting. I'm not sold that that West, you know, 8 seed is locked up by any stretch. I think that's one of the biggest stories here. Even though they've got a nice gap in the standings right now, Memphis does, you know, I think that, you know, this upcoming road trip is going to tell them a lot. You know, if they go 0-4, which is possible, or 1-3, there's going to be an opportunity for teams to not, you know, to kind of nip up on their heels. And there's a bunch of teams that are still kind of in position to do that. And I think with the Pelicans, like, you know, they've had trouble stringing together consistent performances all season long, right? For sure. But, you know, the Zion stuff, you know, the plus minus numbers are very overwhelming. They play a lot better with him. And, you know, I'm just crossing my fingers that he stays healthy down the stretch. And, you know, this turns into something where, you know, it's like one of those, you know, classic Western Conference 8-seed things where it doesn't get decided until like the last night of the year.
You realize that by March 14th, New Orleans could be like 16 games below 500.
You're all the way out, man.
No,
you're a Zion hater.
I'm not. I'm actually a New Orleans lover who's so frustrated with the fact that every year their numbers peak out. They're supposed to be great, and every year they're not great. It leads me to believe that there's just something not right there in regards to the winning column, and until that gets fixed, I can't buy in.
Yeah, I just look at – I mean, right now I think I'm looking at a strength of schedule thing where Memphis has the toughest remaining strength of schedule – and New Orleans has the easiest in the entire league remaining strength of schedule. I just think that's going to balance out. I guess that's my point. I'm not picking against Ja. I'm not picking against Memphis. I just think it's going to get interesting.
It's probably why I might go with the Blazers as making the playoffs at some point here, or someone other than – I mean, I'm not sure I'm convinced that Memphis is making the playoffs. And I mean, I know 538 still has the Pelicans at 40, Blazers at 39, and Memphis at 38. I'm aware of these things. I'm just telling you that I've watched the Pelicans break, like, just continually lose games they're supposed to win. All right, before we wrap on storylines, I want to get a little thought. You're welcome to change these. The 2 seed in the East will be, and the 2 seed in the West will be.
Man, that's a really tough one. I like, to me, I guess I would still default to sort of my preseason picks on these. I do still have faith in the Clippers to kind of pull this thing out. Some of the schedule numbers that you were describing there seem to favor them and the Rockets over the Nuggets and the Jazz. I think that, you know, I'll default to the Clippers on that one. It's kind of a boring pick. Now, Raptors and Celtics, to me, that is an absolute toss-up for that number two seed. Toronto's been playing incredible basketball. Both teams, I think, are going to try to charge hard through the finish line. Like, I don't think there's going to be anyone, you know, taking things lightly down the stretch. I guess, gun to my head, I would say I'll just still take the Raptors just because they have a slight, you know, lead heading out of the break. But, you know, to me, I don't, you know, I expect that series, if they face each other, to go to seven games. I mean, I think it would be an absolute dogfight. I really don't think there's too much separating those two teams.
The final one I would point out that we have not talked about, we probably should have, is the Philadelphia 76ers next 29 games. Probably has the biggest, or 20, I think they've played 55, so a little less than that. They will probably have the largest long-term impact on the landscape of the league than any other team's final set of games.
No, it's a great call. My only counter argument for leaving them off my list is I don't want to have to watch them, Locke. I'm sick of them. I'm over them. You know, figure your stuff out. I'm at that point with them. And, you know, until we get to the second round and they're smacking a team that we all thought maybe they would lose to, then, okay, I might actually give them the time of day. But, I mean, all the smoke about the locker room stuff, you know, all the trying to put the pieces back together, and Embiid and Simmons are trying to play nice at All-Star Weekend. I mean, the fit issues are still going to be there. I don't really trust their best five from an offensive standpoint. They haven't performed consistently. I kind of am doubting Embiid night to night at this point. I mean, coming out of last year's playoffs, that was the big question. Can you trust him throughout an entire series? And, you know, we've really had a lot of trust issues with his play and his availability throughout this season. So they've got to win me back. You know, I guess that's where I come from. But I hear your point. Like, any of those players could be traded this summer. Like, I don't think there's a single guy on that roster who's untouchable, especially if they go out in the first or second round.
Ben Golliver, Washington Post. Go to Ben, follow Ben on Twitter, and go to his homepage on Twitter and follow his weekly newsletter you can get out of the Washington Post. It's absolutely fantastic. And keep reading all of his great stuff. Follow him on Instagram as well. I'm David Locke. This has been Locked On NBA. Now tell your smart device to play the most recent episode of Podcast Rejecting the Screen.